I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to another Empire Podcast interview special. Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning is currently gracing cinemas around the world, and if you are among the millions of people who have seen it so far, you most likely have had your mind blown by the stunts that Tom Cruise performs in the movie as Ethan Hunt, whether it's in the intensely claustrophobic submarine sequence or the daredevilry of the biplane sequence. Cruise is front and centre, of course, and Christopher McQuarrie wrote and directed those sequences, but they wouldn't have been half as effective, I'd wager, without the expert input of the film's second unit director and stunt coordinator, Wade Eastwood. No relation to Clint, in case you're wondering. Eastwood, who hails from South Africa, where the biplane sequence was shot, has been stunt coordinator on all four Cruise McQuarrie missions. But as he told me when we caught up recently on Zoom, this was by far the most challenging and dangerous yet. Now, this interview isn't a spoiler special, but in order to talk about the sequences freely, Eastwood and I do go into spoiler territory from time to time, even if I'm trying to keep it vague on the plot side of things. Just in case you haven't seen The Final Reckoning and have decided to listen to it anyway, in a move so ballsy that Ethan Hunt might try to recruit you for the IMF. So do be careful, tread cautiously in case you haven't seen the movie. For everyone else though, rush headlong into this like Ethan Hunt running down the wing. Move over, Mo Salah. Here's Wade Eastwood. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
We're delighted to be joined on this Empire Podcast interview special by Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning's second unit director and stunt coordinator, a man who's been trying to drop Tom Cruise off buildings, planes, all sorts of stuff over the last few years. It is Wade Eastwood. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
No, I'm very good. Thanks for doing this, because you're about to buzz off on holiday, I'm presuming, a well-earned break?
A little bit of work break. Yeah, we get off to Monaco to the F1.
Okay, so yeah. It's a busman's holiday.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you had a break, Wade?
I have, actually. Yeah, for the first time in, the 6 years we've done, the last two Dead Reckonings, which took, I was on it for 6 years. So yeah, I've had a little break. Good to, rekindle with the family and see what my family looked like.
Remember their faces. Because, I've spoken to, McHugh, I've spoken to Eddie Hamilton, I've spoken to a lot of people who worked on these movies. And I'm concerned about your well-being and your exhaustion levels, because
no, it's good.
Okay.
It's good. You've got to be mission ready, and it's like a boot camp. Like, some people like, you know, an easy class, some people like a hard class. We don't have a choice. We have a very hard class. But it's what keeps us going.
So talk me through the final reckoning then, because in terms of it being a hard class, was this the most difficult challenge that you've had working on these movies to date?
Yes. I mean, I say it every mission, because every mission is harder. You know, we're trying to, you know, do action sequences that haven't been done before. We're trying to shoot them in a way that you can be very subjective with the character, so you feel the emotional sort of arc, the journey of the character. And that's really the hardest part, is trying to put the camera in the right place, because, you know, we could shoot a base jump, we could shoot a stunt objectively, but really trying to, you know, capture that and keep connected to the character, that is by far the hardest thing. And then, you know, where we can put our safety measures in place and how far we can push the action, but then suddenly there's a camera there and it's like, oh, now we've got to add a whole new, you know, risk assessment and a whole new rehearsal schedule to now do it with the camera where we need it. Yeah. Because obviously the speeds we're doing on the plane or skydiving or free falling, you know, you hit an object, it's going to go straight through you. So it's very logistically challenging, but so rewarding at the end when it comes off.
By and large, the focus from you and McHugh and Tom was on the submarine sequence and on the biplane sequence. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, the submarine sequence was such a challenge, you know, to build sets that huge, you know, scale size sets, if you like, that also that, you know, that have three axes that can roll and pitch, that can submerge. And the weight, the tonnage of water that we had, you know, when we submerge that set or we rotate it, the currents in that set were so strong, like they would be if there was a hole in the side of a submarine. So when it rotated or sunk, you were being drawn, like sucked in to the mechanics of the rig through the set. So we had to adjust Tom had to adjust the swim and the action and the story beats to accommodate for the complete disorientation. It was, you know, when I first started testing that, I would just lose the visual. I always test with Tom because he's my stuntman, if you like, before he becomes Tom the actor. because he moves in a different way and he knows what he's doing with the character. So I have to test with him. There's no one better to test with because he's also very good at action. So, you know, we do all our initial testing, obviously safety testing on our own. And then we, you know, in comes Tom and we start working it out slowly, incrementally. But then you start speeding up and then he was gone, like in just bubbles, just disappeared completely, lost full visual. So I have safety things that I give to my guys, chain link down the set, with lights, commands, and hand signals. So if the hand signal can't be seen, the lights can be seen. If the lights can't be seen, there's a sound can be heard. So I've got backups for my backups. And they, you know, we sort of send them all off. And I'm like, okay, which one did you get? And I was like, well, I didn't see you at all. I didn't see the light. I barely heard the sound. So, okay, we're going to change that. We're going to do this. So we work out all that so that we're safe. And then when Tom's in there, you know, you're in there and the whole set starts rotating and, you know, it's like stop, and it's only done a quarter of a turn. You're like, where the hell are we? Like, where was that? Which door did I come in? It's over there. It's in the top corner, you know. And it was really, it took like a lot of seat time, which I always use that expression because, you know, the more you do, the more comfortable you get and orientated with it. But it took a lot of seat time until we would come to be in there talking, Tom and I, while the sets are rotating and things are falling, and we'd be like discussing stuff with hand signals. And then a new safety diver would be just watching from the outside and you just see him like surface. I'm like, you're right. And he's like, oh, I feel sick. It's like, it was very, very daunting. It was hugely dangerous. It was a lot of prep to make it safe. But when you were in there, the creaking metal, the size of it, the current, the bubbles, the moving, you know, big full scale torpedoes that were falling dry because half the set was dry. So they'd splash into the top. So if you're on the surface, you'd be crushed. You know, so we knew that. So we had to work around, all right, we can't be in near the surface for this part of the turn. When this light or this signal goes to there, we can go to the surface. And then I had people on the surface watching if something got snagged and didn't go where it should. We aborted and hit the e-stop. So there were so many things. We had, you know, I had 5-6 spotters. We had so many things going on from so many different places that as we got into it, if you walked on set new, you'd be like, you guys are crazy. But actually, it was so rehearsed and so planned to get to that point that it was still slightly crazy, but just not as crazy as the beginning.
Well, it is fascinating because I was lucky enough to be on set for a Sevastopol sequence, so I saw the submarine set, which is this gargantuan set had been built with this huge water tank, these gigantic columns, and you were able to take bits of the set in and out and replace them with different bits. So you were able to stay in the one place, take
it was an incredible feat, incredible feat of engineering.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, our special effects department did an incredible job, yeah.
And it's and then the set could rotate, what, 360 or close to it?
Oh, keep going. Yeah, it could keep going. It could rotate endlessly.
Wow. I mean, and you got all this water and the current, as you say. And I remember speaking to McHugh on the day that I visited, and I had been given a tour of the sets as well, and I'd seen the torpedo chamber room. And we were talking about the stunts that, you know, you guys had done, the biplane stuff. And he said the most dangerous thing is coming up. We're shooting it in 2 weeks.
The torpedo.
It's the torpedo chamber.
Yeah, the torpedo room. Because, you know, the easiest thing in the world to do would have had Tom swim through and react to CG torpedoes.
Yeah.
That would have been the way. But then you get CG bubble trails and you get, you know, you got to match plate shots and you got to do it on. And it's just, you know, you've done this whole amazing sequence, real. And then suddenly swimming through some of the audience are like, nah, we can see that CG. I'm disconnected. And Tom just does not want an audience disconnected. He wants them to feel, he doesn't want them to be cheated. You know, you paid for your ticket, you're going to be entertained. And he loves film. So he wants to, he just wants to do it for real as much as he can. And as an actor, he wants to react to these things, you know? So the more torpedoes we added, the McHugh's like, oh, wait, can we get one more in there? I'm like, McHugh, you know, you're killing me. But it's so then we'd have to go back and test. And I'm like, yeah, I think we can do it with two. What about three? And then next minute we've got five. And then it's like, you know, so we did a lot of testing. We're talking months to get it to the point where everything was moving and going where it should be. Because if it's uncontrolled, we're not doing it. Yeah. So it's got to look uncontrolled, but it's always controlled. It's always safe, you know, apart from if a current took him in the wrong place slightly, he's going to get knocked out or he's going to get trapped. And he did get trapped once or twice, you know, where we stopped the set and pulled him out. You know, it's I'm within 2 seconds of him always on that set.
So you're in the water as well.
Yeah. And it's weird because, like, you know, in the day we're making movies, you're not saving lives, you know, but we're in a scenario like that. Every day at work, I feel like, you know, I'm watching a friend of mine in a perilous situation, and you go in without thinking. Like when he got trapped once, it wasn't bad because Tom can hold his breath for a long time, you know. But he got trapped once, and before he even had finished being trapped, I was already pulling the thing off him. I was in there, and then my safety followed me in, and the rig was stopped. You know, the protocol worked, but I actually went in without thinking about the other torpedoes behind me. It was like it's just you react, and I think it's. I've been asked before, but I mean, I'd do it for anyone. It's just the way I'm wired. But with him, he gives so much and he's so focused on entertaining and doing the shot and making it perfect. And he appreciates all the crew, all the work they've done to get to this point, you know, the rigging and the fabrication of equipment, that I can sort of see that he deserves, he deserves, like everyone deserves to be helped out, but he really deserves it because he puts so much in. It's a hard way to explain it, but like, I go without thinking.
No, absolutely. And what's interesting as well about the underwater sequence is that the suit that Tom is wearing, I don't know whether people really understand that, but in real life, Tom has a very limited oxygen supply. He's got about 10 minutes.
Yeah, and because we designed this helmet so that you can actually see him, this face mask. Otherwise, you know, you've just got little eyes, and telling a story like that's very difficult when the rest is covered. And Tom's all about, you know, the character. So we designed a mask and then designed lighting for it and designed the angle so that we didn't get all this refracted light and, you know, sort of weird curves, which was distorting your face. And then when the design was great, then the testing started and Tom was like, yeah, it works great underwater. I can move around and he can shake his head. He can get tossed around. I can drag him. But what we didn't know at the time is that all the air that normally escapes through a regulator wasn't escaping. So your recycled buildup of dirty air, if you like, without getting technical, he's rebreathing. And he would do a small take sometimes and just be exhausted. I'm like, what's going on? Because that's not like him. He's a machine. You know, he can go forever. And he didn't know either. He's like, dude, I'm just tired today. I don't know what's going on. And we eventually worked it out after many, many weeks. We worked out why he's so tired, and we did a test, and we monitored it, and we saw that, you know, he was really, you know, pushing himself beyond.
Because he's basically breathing CO2 at that point.
100%.
Yeah.
And yeah, so then we worked out some things to try and purify and clear it with fans. It made it a little bit better. But at the end of the day, to capture the face and to capture the character, he had to just live with it and do it. And he did.
It's incredible. Those moments as well where the sub is rolling and rotating and you can literally see the water shifting as well.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
It was incredible. And, you know, there was every movie we exhaust Tom because he exhausts himself. You know, the training schedules are brutal and he's doing crazy stuff. And he, you know, the motocross jumps on the last one, endless motocross jumps and skydiving and falling through. But these particular two sequences, like, you know, rebreathing his dirty air and exhausting himself internally, as well as physically climbing around that heavy suit, climbing when holding on when it goes dry. So now you've gone weightless to full weight with this wet suit that weighs a ton of all this stuff on you. And then you fall back into water and you've got to work out where you are, where's what's up and down. And then the wing of the plane. I mean, that was brutal. Despite the danger of the sequence and the, you know, epic nature and scale of that sequence, we started testing to see what it was like. We put big V8 special effects fans in front of the plane and we tied it down on the ground and we blasted those and put the prop on. And Tom walked around the wing and, I mean, he was like, yeah, wow, that's a hard workout, but I think it's good. And then we went flying and added low G, positive G, you know, with all the hammerheads and rolls and turns and particles in the air and a different pitch on the prop that had to pitch differently for different maneuvers. And it was exhausting. It was, you know, even putting your hand out, like putting your hand out the car window, doing 120 mm-hmm. miles an hour, you see the effect. Now put your whole body out and then turn your body to the wind so that you're creating maximum drag that you possibly can, which makes it really hard for the guy to fly the plane, but also just beats the hell out of you. Yeah, and every little detail, you know, like the lapels of Tom's jacket were like, on the first take, just slapped. It was like he was getting slapped in the face by 100 times a minute. Everything just beat the hell out of him on that movie. It really did. So, you know, I give him kudos and respect because he did a great job.
How did you sit down? How did you plan that sequence with Tom and McHugh?
On the biplane?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was, you know, they had a sequence. Tom and McHugh had a sequence and they really wanted to do it. And then, you know, you start working out once you get a plane where you can go, where you can't go, how I can safely rig him, but still give him freedom of movement, how we can transfer from one plane to the other, how we can be on the plane with him, but not be on the plane with him, to change rigging points and to do stuff during a maneuver. And so it was a lot of logistics that went into the back of it. And then as we start doing it, the sequence then develops organically because, oh, I can't do that, but jeez, you remember that mistake when the guy snap rolled me and I went flying onto the other wing? Well, that was even cooler. So let's take the story that way. You know, sort of through a half dazed Tom as he sort of explains it because he's been whipped from one wing to the other. And, you know, that was exciting and it was natural. It happened. So let's do it because the audience will connect with that. It was natural. So it evolves and then I'll re-rig and, you know, test on the ground different things. And then and I said, Tom, I think you'll like this. You'll go up. And it's like, oh, yeah, it was great. Yeah, the wire didn't get involved. And it didn't get, you know, wrapped around me. Or I love that. I can do more with it this way. And, you know, and then, you know, before we went flying, I went up to the biplane with the pilot and tested it with a dummy. I never put another human on the wing. It was always Tom. Mm. But initially, we didn't know, you know, what we could do. And some pilots were like, no, you can't be on the wing past this point. And I'm like, well, let's just try it with a dummy. So I rigged a dummy on wires and I had the dummy so it could pivot from profile to face on. So the drag was different. So the worst case scenario, the dummy would be right at the tip of the wing because that would make the plane roll. So that make sure that the pilot had full stick the opposite direction so that he could maintain the plane level. If he couldn't, then we had to stop. And then that's as far as we could go. And then with the dummy turned with full drag to the wind, obviously then the plane wants to do this.
Yeah.
So the pilot's got full opposite pedal to make sure he can have as much pedal. So we had to do a flight control test to make sure that it could be flown. And if it couldn't, we had to then be able to bring that dummy back in obviously, so we could land. And then we tested and tested and tested incrementally over weeks and weeks, and found that we could actually do a hell of a lot. We adjusted the engines on the plane, and we like a Formula One car, we just adapted the plane to suit the action. Change the surface of the wings in some areas, and we did lots of little tricks to so that Tom could, because we slammed down on the wing, he goes straight through it. It's like it's a paper wing, so we had to make some mods. And Tom, you know, I mean, Tom, some days we'd come off and that plane was like, we had to change wings. I mean, Tom had beaten the wing to death. Yeah, it was pretty incredible. But you know, but by the same token, there was no stuntman I would have put on that wing to do a better job or give me different feedback, because Tom was so seasoned at doing that and so good at it. And he's a stuntman that can act, really, at the end of the day, or an actor that can do his own stunts. He's that we just get so much feedback from him. And then we know how to develop the rigs and how to push further with the action.
I mean, there's so many moments in the biplane sequence that just boggle my mind. The one moment that I think might surprise people in terms of the danger, because on screen it's a moment when Ethan is clinging to the first biplane and it lifts off the ground, and it just, you know, it feels like when you're watching it on screen, it's like, oh, okay, that's just a normal day for Tom Cruise. But that's incredibly dangerous, right, Wade? I mean, because you've got no clearance at all, you've got no space, there's no room for error at all.
No, there's nothing. The first test I did on that, actually, because we tested over these trees in the mountains in the Drakensberg in South Africa, which was stunning. I mean, that's the area where I grew up, you know, in Durban and Schlange Rocks. And so it was amazing to take a film of that size, and to take Tom back to my hometown, my home country. It was incredible for them to see it. But yeah, we're flying over the trees and we're like monitoring the dummy. And I was hanging on this, you know, underneath, watching the dummy, how close we can go to the trees. And I just remember the pilot who was doing the testing, like, you're not really going to put him down there, though. Yeah, it's bad enough for the dummy, but you're not really. I'm like, yeah, no, he's going to be down there. So I was actually down underneath, like doing the call. And I was saying, down five, down five, down five, like calling down. He's like, and the pilot would come, no, I'm down enough. And I'm like, you know, we'd have to rebrief. No, you have to listen. I'm watching. Down five, down five. And then you see Tom lift his feet up over the trees and stuff. And I mean, the pilot was so, he was brilliant, but at the end of the day, we'd wrap and he's like, I need to go and get a drink. And Tom was all bright eyed, like, why? What's the matter? That was the most fun I've ever had.
Yeah. You know? As long as he's only drinking at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
I've spoken to McHugh a lot over the years about this concept of ducks and the idea that before any take, you know, the entire crew and the cast will be asked, do you have any ducks? As in, do you have any small problems in your life that could accumulate to the point where it distracts you from your job, or maybe you haven't noticed something that you need to notice and therefore the stunt could go wrong and that could endanger Tom? You know, I imagine there were a lot of duck moments during the biplane sequence. And does Tom ever put his hand up and go, actually, I've got
100%.
A duck?
I mean, Tom's a pilot. He's an aviator and he's you know, he enjoys his life. He doesn't want to die, you know. As much as we're watching his movies, you all think, you know, everyone thinks I'm constantly trying to kill him and he just won't die. He's very sensible with that. So it could be anything. You know, the pilots could be fatigued. When he's flying and he's the pilot, he could be fatigued. It could have been a rough day the day before. The weather could have been a bit turbulent in the morning, and we're waiting for it to clear and we're sort of rushing something. And so we would all look, and he respects, a duck was never questioned. Yeah. A duck was never negotiated. No one negotiated you out of a duck. If anyone said, any ducks? And we were like, no ducks. Occasionally a pilot would put up, I've got one duck on the weather in this canyon. So we'd stay away from that canyon. I've got one duck for this. And if we got three ducks, we're out. We didn't fly that day. Wow. For whatever reason, someone was a bit tired. Someone had bad news the night before, something that wasn't perfect. Cause we, you know, there's a shot in the trailer that's seen a lot. You see the two biplanes going down the river, in Hoedspruit in South Africa, and they're going down this rocky river. Now Tom's on the wing and everyone's like, oh my God, Tom's on the wing. That's crazy. And it is crazy. But if we have an engine failure or there's a problem or a pilot's not at 100%, so you're flying in hot conditions, the plane's not creating a lot of lift, it's at the top end of its RPM, and you're flying sort of not on the limit, but you're flying up by the limits. and you've got Tom on the wing of the plane. If that plane has an engine failure, it's not doing an emergency landing, it's crashing. Yeah. And most likely it's going to be a fatality in that area of Rocky River. You know, you might be lucky and stick in a bushy tree and, you know, and duck down and survive it with some cuts and bruises. You know, you can land those planes quite slowly sometimes, depending on if you've got a headwind. But on those conditions where it was no wind, dry, hot, density, altitude, everything was against you, and Tom's climbing around the wing, you know, you've got to, what audiences don't realize is the other factors. So those planes were F1 aircraft. They landed, and as soon as they touched down, a team went in, bang. Every single nut, bolt, point was checked. Engine temperatures, pressures, oils, everything checked. Everything. Any duck on the plane, grounded straight away. Even if it, you know, even if you weren't sure, grounded. Next plane. Whereas we had a backup plane for everything.
Yeah.
And that's the way it had to be, because the things are out of my control. I can do all the testing with dummies. I can test with Tom. I can rig the safeties. I can have the backup parachute for the pilot. I can do everything I can do. But once that plane takes off, I'm at the mercy of the pilot and the mechanics of the aircraft. So that has to be perfect.
Jesus. And then also you have the helicopter, the McHugh's in, which is very, very close by as well. You have cameras all around as well.
When you say by, I mean, we're talking inches sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Will and Phil, who are our team in the camera ship. I mean, Will Banks, incredible pilot. But him and Phil, amazing operator as well. And I mean, they were incredible. That was an amazing, the team, the whole team, my team, you know, the aerial team, you know, the ground crew, everyone, to make that sequence happen at the scale and the limits that we did was, you know, it was controlled. Yes, it was rehearsed. It was put together correctly, but we still, I don't think there'll ever be an aerial sequence like that again.
And I spoke to Tom for the magazine about a number of the stunts that he's done over the years for this franchise. And we talked about the A400 sequence from Rogue Nation. And he told me something I don't think he's said before, at least I don't think I'd heard it before in an interview, which is that on one of the, I think it may even have been the first takeoff, that something did hit him, that he felt something hit him, like just a little bit of debris. And that, you know, at altitude, that could have killed him. And he carried on and didn't tell anyone that that had happened. On this, are there comparable instances where maybe something, he didn't mention something until the next day. Oh, by the way, I nearly got hit by that, or a propeller shaved my eyebrows off or something.
You know, or cracked some ribs and bruised some ribs and didn't tell anyone. That's why, you know, I'd give him the morning and always, you know, give him a good hug and say good morning or something. You know, he's a good mate of mine and, you know, adore the guy. And he'd be like, oh, and I'm like, what was that? And it was also my other way of seeing if he had any injuries. And he's like, no, I'm fine. And then I'd like poke him and he'd be, oh, and I'm like, okay. What happened? Lift up the shirt. There's a little bit of bruising. What's that? Oh, it was when I slammed on the wing that time. And, you know, but it's old school. You know, these days you'd probably hear about it before anything happened. Whereas with this sort of more, you know, he's a tough nut for sure. I've seen him bounce in training and testing and motocross and everything. He bounces like a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
I mean, he just bounces and gets up with a big smile on his face and off he goes. But you know, we do things incrementally in stages, and that's why if we went for gold from the get go, the bounce wouldn't be a bounce; it would be a break or you know, a life changing injury. So we do things in stages. We do things until he's so competent that there is no one better to do it.
Yeah,
he's not Tom. He's Tom to me when we train. He's not Tom Cruise. I train him as Tom, like I would train any stunt guy, and we work together like that. And it has to be that way because there's no special treatment, and he would never ask for special treatment. It's not in his makeup, you know. So he trained until he's so competent. There's no one better to do it, and then he does it.
So, but even so, that in mind, how do you tackle moments in the biplane sequence? There are moments when the plane goes upside down, the engine stops.
Yeah,
you did that for real.
Well, it does it naturally. It'll only fly so long upside down because the oil, you know, eventually and the engine cuts out and you have to restart it. But it's nerve-wracking from the ground when, you know, he's hanging there and it's like, oof, just starts falling and you're waiting and it feels like an eternity. You're like, come on, come on, come on. Because you're in the canyons of a mountain, you know, like up that's obviously at altitude. We do those, not low level. And it's like, but then you're getting low level and then you hear, and it starts up again and it's like, wow, and it dives out the canyon. He's still hanging on the bottom, on the back. So it's, yeah, it was very stressful. I mean, that's where I lost my hair. So.
Yeah, before you started this movie, you had hair. McHugh had a long, full head of black hair.
Not a length. he's aging me.
What was the most hair losing moment then? Wait, it was because of hair raising, but but just it.
Just for my benefit.
Yeah.
It was the biplane for sure. It was I'm quite protective of my team, the people I work with, all the other actors, Hayley, Pom, Simon, everyone, Tarzan, when we're training, I become very protective because they put so much trust in you. So, it's just the way I am. I become super protective and, I can do all I can. But again, once he takes off, I'm just pacing until he comes back. I'm monitoring radios. I'm pacing. I'm looking at weather. I'm looking at anything I can from the ground, but there's nothing I can do. I'm in the air. And then when I see him land again in the old wave, it's all good again. It's every moment on a mission film is hair losing, hair raising. and there's no way to get around it, but you wouldn't have it any other way. It's such an adventure, and not just for the audience, for the crew. Like the way movies are being made these days, you stay in a studio and you do a lot on green screen, a lot of films, not all of them.
Yeah.
But the majority. And where can you go with a crew all in helicopters? You've got like 20 helicopters flying in convoy to the middle of a mountain to land and then set up camp and then work from there for the rest of the day and then heli back at sunset and, be in formation all together. And Tom comes up in the biplane next to you and gives you a little signal and waves and goes and lands or does a roll. And it sounds made up, but the Mission Impossible films are such an adventure for all of us that. When you come off it, first of all, we all get sick. You get like the flu because the adrenaline just drops. And I end up pacing around my house, like opening and closing drawers and, doing things. My wife just watches me for 2 or 3 weeks. I just don't know what to do with myself. I'm like all over the place.
Yeah, I can imagine. But there's just one last thing I wanted to ask about before I let you go, which is the moment. People are probably sick of hearing me talk about this on the pod, but I've mentioned several times in the podcast that there was a moment I saw. I was lucky enough to see some footage before I spoke to Tom and McHugh for the magazine, and there was one shot in there of an aerial stunt that made me yelp out loud. And as I said to you earlier on, before we started recording, when I spoke to Tom, my first words were, "I don't know how you're still alive." And that moment is the free fall. So it was the parachute burns away. Ethan does a free fall. He's grappling with something. I won't spoil what it is. He's grappling with something. Now, Tom obviously has a parachute on him, but he is free falling. For how long and for how many feet was he free falling, and how shit scared were you at that point?
Too long is the answer for that for that question, because, we had a set of parameters, but the thing that was very difficult, and Tom makes it difficult, is he had this big Snorri rig on him, this camera that came off the front of him. And we went and tested at higher altitude. And again, I had an amazing aerial, with Scott Armstrong, and I had Malachi, my skydiver, in the air with him. And to Tom, when he exited, he could be on his belly with his camera sticking out in front of him, like 6 feet, 5, 6 feet. And then he went over into his back, and then he has to turn back to his belly to open his parachute. But you got this big arm in front of you, and then trying to turn back over, they kept catching the wind and flicking him back to his back. So he couldn't turn on his belly to open his parachute. So we did, this is testing, not shooting. So we did testing of this big open field miles away from anyone. And we had a release on the camera. Uh-huh. So we had a fake camera put on at the correct weight, an old camera body and everything, so we could have the exact weight as is going to be the same wind resistance and drag and everything, but not actually a camera because we don't want to waste the money. And pull the release, and then you have to hold the thing and pull it, because if you just pull the release, the arm will come off and smash you in the face. So he has to hold the rig, pull the release, throw the camera away, turn onto his belly, open his parachute. And we had a time that you only have this many seconds, you know, of trying to turn on your belly before you have to release it. So, you know, camera come crashing down to the ground, we'd, you know, bodge it together and go back on and test again and test again, and then try and adapt the body, you know, where you're going to bring your arm in more, you're going to create the spin much quicker, you're going to force the spin and open up again quick. So it's like very much like free flying skydiving, but at a very high level to try and compensate for this arm sticking out that's constantly trying to flick you onto your back. And I mean, I wish audiences could see that, because the testing that goes on is sometimes way more exciting than anything else, because, you know, but it's very controlled. Like, okay, that took that many seconds and that took that. All right, let's try this on the next one. And Tom's like, yeah, what could I do? Okay, let me try this and let me try that. And up we go. And we just drill it until he can turn on his front every single time, both ways, from different things, every single time. And then have Malachi go out and disturb him, make him, you know, tumbling, turn onto your front. So it's not always the same orientation. And then we got that nailed. That was great. And now you've got the burning parachute. So you've got my team up and, you know, we're in the helicopter. We've got the parachute, which has been soaked specially. So it's in a isolated box because we don't want to fire in the helicopter. It would be bad. the pilot, we have a pilot that I, you know, put in there with a parachute. He's got a parachute on. Everyone's got parachutes in case the chopper does go up in flames, we can all bail. And we have a special treated box. I've got Alan, who does my skydive work, who's incredible. We had this special box with the way the lines were flaked and everything, so that when we time to go, everything's prepped, the box is open, and he goes out, you know, and everything goes with him, hopefully. Yeah. And then he has to, whilst acting and pretending to put the pod cover and all this stuff, he's actually lighting the thing himself. In amongst those hand movements, he's actually lighting his parachute, which people don't know. So he's turning the camera on before he jumps out, and then he's lighting. So he's doing the whole shot in effect. He's the special effects guy, and he's the camera operator, and he's finding the light while spinning. And then you obviously the parachute burns. So you're under canopy, you get that moment of woof, I'm upright, and then poof, it goes, and then you have to release the trailing lines, because if those get caught, which was another concern of ours, which is why we tested everything with lines. If those lines wrap around the camera and you eject the camera because you can't get on your front, it stays with you.
Oh, my God.
So we had to be able to burn the lines to a point that they weren't long enough to snag. All these stuff went on in logistics. I won't bore you with the details, but there was a lot of testing to get to the point of safety where it was safe and it went efficiently over and over again. But as soon as he releases the line, so he gets rid of those little lines, they're gone. And then he just drops again. And where we shot it in the Drakensberg, we were up at high. Our landing site, LZ there, our drop zone was at 6,500 feet.
Okay.
But we're up at like 16,000-17,000 feet on the drop. And he would disappear into the sort of 10,000 foot of mountain. He would disappear like into the silhouette of the mountain. So it looks like he was just going into the ground from where we were looking up the mountain. So he would be free falling and then down, and we'd like, poof, you just see the reserve open. It was nerve-wracking. And then we'd chase him in the heli and go and get him and then recover all the parachute, burning parachute debris.
And then he'd do it another, 15 times?
Did it so many times. We did it so many times. I didn't tell him, but I actually hid the lost burning parachute because I didn't want him to do it anymore.
That's amazing. So what was his trigger for pulling the reserve?
So, it was a little special effects wire. They did an amazing job too, special effects. And they wired a little igniter. But he's like, but I'm doing the Podkova, so I can't do the igniter. So we had to build that into the action of the Podkova, where he has a little switch on the inside of his hand. And then during that, he clicks the button and then... And then he's got to get things out of his pockets and put them back before he pulls the thing. And, you know, it was.
So he doesn't have to count down. He's not counting down. That's not another thing he has to think about. Like, oh, okay, after 30 seconds, I have to pull my chute.
Yeah, no, so when he jumps out, the parachute is automatic deployment, burning parachute, because it's in a special box. Yeah. So he comes out, that opens.
Yeah.
He has to have it ignited within 7 seconds. Otherwise, the fuel on the parachute dries up. And then we don't get a full ignition, we get a partial, like little, pss, 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 you know, and it's sort of, he's flying a sort of really unstable, partially burnt parachute, which, so he had to do that before it all vaporized. He had to ignite it. Then he had to release that, release the lines, free fall, whilst being in the shot with a camera showing himself as Ethan, you know, doing the action as a character.
Yeah.
And then turn onto his stomach if he could. If he couldn't, he's got to get rid of the camera rig, which he didn't want to do because obviously then we don't have the footage. So he wants to keep it. He wants to get onto his stomach and then pull his reserve parachute.
My God.
And then in, on the side of the mountain, 6,500 feet up.
And what's the cutoff point? Is there like 2,000 feet, 3,000 feet above the ground when he has to pull his reserve?
Yeah, ideally. Ideally, yes.
Wait, I'm going to tell you, I have so many ducks just listening to this. I have ducks to the left of me, ducks to the right of me. Unbelievable. It's genuinely unbelievable what you guys did.
My team did an incredible job. You know, I couldn't do it without them, so it was incredible.
You've earned a long break. Are you getting a long break apart from this busman's holiday you're about to go on for a couple of days?
Yeah, well, it's Cannes as well. I'm due to direct a movie called Mister for Thunder Road, so I'm doing a little bit of work on that, and we're casting, so I've got a little bit of work to do. I'm sort of doing loose work, but really I'm having a little break with the family.
Amazing. What can you say about that?
Yeah, just got announced. We're just casting at the moment. It's a really fun script. Mister, you know, quite current, but a father and daughter that have to rekindle their relationship in order to survive because he's an ex-assassin. So if they don't rekindle this estranged relationship they have with each other, then they won't survive. So it's a really cool, it's got a lot of emotion and a lot of really cool characters in it. I didn't just want to direct an action movie. I like things with a lot of character and a lot of story, a lot of emotion, and this is hugely emotional action. So it should be a good one.
Amazing. I wish you all the best with that. And, obviously there's been, over the last few years, there's always been this tradition of stunt people becoming directors. But particularly over the last few years, we've obviously had the likes of David Leitch and Chaz Stahelski and Sam Hargrave and people like that. So,
I was with Chad last night at the Ballerina premiere. It was great. And, nice to see him. He created something amazing with John Wick. He's done really well. And Dave Leitch, they're both old friends of mine. Dave especially, done really, really well. I'm super proud of those guys.
Well, I'm glad you go, but it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. Absolute pleasure.
Indeed. Any ducks?
I've got so many ducks.
We don't have that kind of time. Wade Eastwood, thanks a lot. Cheers.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Okay, that was Wade Eastwood, and if you're looking for more behind-the-scenes Final Reckoning nuggets, boy, you're in luck. This week's regular podcast, out Friday, June 6th, we'll see the team joined in the studio, hopefully, by the film's editor, Eddie Hamilton, and the long-awaited first part of my epic sit-down with the film's writer-director, Christopher McQuarrie, will be up for spoiler special subscribers, hopefully this week, but if not, then early next week. So if you haven't already subscribed, highly to empire.supportingcast.fm and do so now. I promise you, you won't regret it. Choose to accept. Okay, that's enough for me. I'm off to strap myself to the wing of a plane. I don't see what could possibly go wrong. Ducks? We don't need no stinking ducks. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.